If you had a rough weekend because of football, or just because this is statistically the gloomiest time of the year, we are kicking off our week here on KCUR Central Standard with something the internet has proven to be a salve for all wounds: baby animals and how cute they are, starting with a baby penguin. In nature, there's a whole season when baby penguins are hatched from eggs, where they've been kept warm and safe all winter long, in a cozy little space between their dad's feet. All the dads in a colony huddle together while the mom penguins are off fishing for food. PBS captured this moment on a secret penguin cam a few years back.
The chick's calls encourage her unhatched neighbor to emerge as well. In this way, the colony's young all arrive together. The new chick joins over 2,000 others that are starting to appear throughout the colony.
Can you even imagine the sheer adorableness of 2,000 baby penguins hatching at once? We are guessing this is not quite what happened here in Kansas City last week when a baby penguin was born at the zoo. But the baby penguin's name is Blizzard because it was born in a snowstorm, and that is adorable, and we're about to hear the story of its arrival. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Kansas City Zoo's Sean Putney. Hi, Sean.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, tell me everything about Blizzard. The pictures are so cute.
Well, I got to tell you, penguins were the last thing on our mind that morning, just as was the case with everybody else waking up during the blizzard and aftermath and having to dig out. But it just so happened that we had a baby penguin. We were expecting, obviously, it to hatch between a certain day and another certain day, but it just so happened to be that morning. It was to first-time parents, so as is the case with even human parents, you never know how they're going to do the first time around. So we were just like grandparents, keeping a real close eye on them and making sure that everything was going well and they were taking care of it and feeding it. That first day, it's really just about making sure that it stays under mom or dad, and they're keeping it warm and they're protecting it from the others. And then after a couple of days, you start thinking about, okay, is it getting enough groceries to eat from mom and dad? And they've done really well. We compare that to other birds from the past, from other institutions. There's a growth curve, and we look at them adding about 5 to 10%, 5 to 15% of their weight every day.
So this is just like if you have a hospital birth as a human, kind of like what the nurses are running around doing.
Sure. That's our goal, to make sure we have the healthiest of babies. And if the parents aren't taking care of it, we actually have a little ICU of our own. So we can take them off to a brooder if the parents aren't taking care of it. And we've done several things. Sometimes you can put them in the brooder, get their weight back up and make sure that they're hydrated, and then maybe put them back under mom and dad.
But we need to back up and get all of the cute part of this story first, because you jumped from like it's snowing and no one's expecting it to like everything's going great. But like there's a whole birth scene we haven't even heard.
Well, we actually didn't see the hatching going on either. A lot of times these things happen overnight, and the keepers keep a really close eye on things. And they had seen that the egg had hatched, and we pulled.
Did you get a middle of the night phone call?
No middle of the night phone call on this one. But we did pull the baby out, check to see its weight, check to make sure it was healthy.
Because they hatch and then they continue to stay in that little like kind of. I'm sure this has a scientific name, like flap area between the feet.
Yeah, brood pouch.
Brood pouch. Forgive me.
You know, my wife might say I have a brood pouch too, but I don't use it for raising a baby penguin. But yes, that's the purpose of it. And you know, all the different species of penguins have a little bit different way of raising their young. The king penguins and emperor penguins that you're used to seeing in a lot of these documentaries, they do have that little flap that keeps their babies warm. But there's other penguins that dig burrows underneath bushes or inside of rocks, or they have little rock nests. So it really just depends on what's available available for the birds and where they're at.
And at the zoo, we've got king penguins, right?
We have three different types. We have king penguins. They're the really tall ones. They look like they have little yellow ear flaps. Then we have Gentoo penguins, which are a little bit smaller, and they share the space with the king penguins. And then we have Humboldt penguins, which are found in Peru and Chile.
So which one is Blizzard?
He's a king penguin. It's our first that we've hatched from parents here at the zoo. Last year, we had a little bit different scenario. The St. Louis Zoo had some eggs that they were incubating. The parents weren't incubating it, and they asked us if we wanted to get experience by doing that ourselves. So last year, we hand-raised one ourselves. This year, we're actually blessed by having a parent-laid egg here at Kansas City, and they're doing the work, as we always hope will happen.
So did you set up the, like, mom and dad penguin, or did they find each other in a more organic kind of way?
Well, they do pick out each other, but it's interesting you say that, because we try to have genetic diversity in all of our animals, whether it be here or all across the United States at other zoos. So we work together, and we have what are called species survival plans, and in that, you have what's called literally a stud book for each of these groups. So with penguins in particular, you have birds that are better suited genetically to breed with other birds. So it's almost like an animal dating book.
Weird. So you try to like stage it, but then it's up to them.
Right. And we have had some little private time sessions when we've had birds that haven't been pairing with the ones that we've wanted them to. We have a little off.
Just invite them over for dinner.
We have behind the scenes areas where we've had these romantic interludes, or we've tried to create romantic interludes for the birds.
How do you try to create a romantic interlude for a penguin?
Just giving them time on their own in a secluded area. We hope that they create a bond, and it's worked a couple times, so that's great.
So the scene that we just heard about from the PBS documentary with this penguin cam, and it was in, I think, like March of the Penguins as well, where they're all kind of hatching at once in a big community. I guess a colony is the word for it.
Right.
That does not sound to be what you're describing. You're describing a single penguin hatching.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because we actually do have another pair that's sitting on an egg as well. Now, when you watch these documentaries, and they have much better voices than I do. It's always neat to hear them talking in their little accents. But they do tend to do it at the same time of year, but it's not always, they're not always all hatching at the same instant. So you might have some birds that are hatching a week or two beforehand and some that are hatching a little bit later, but they all are during a season. And the reason for that is it's usually a better time of the year for them to do that. Maybe it's a little warmer. Maybe that's when more of the fish are around. And so they all come together as a group, safety and numbers sort of thing as well. But in our situation, we only have so many birds. But if we had them all,
instead of 2,000,
right? If we had a much larger group, they would all be doing it right now. And the reason why they're doing it now in the blizzard time is because they're from the southern hemisphere, so this would really be the time of year that would be their summer, and that's how we have it set up.
So they're not responding to like the atmosphere telling them what season it is. It's really like some internal clock.
A little bit. We fooled them a touch. So our lighting, if you go into our building, this is the time of year where we mimic the summers in the southern hemisphere. So this is the most light that you'll see in our exhibit throughout the year. If you go in there in June.
I do need to go there, actually. Like, I need that kind of light so bad.
So come to the zoo, and we'll provide you with that summer look if you hang out in the penguin building all day. But in the summertime, that dwindles down. So that's why if you're there in the afternoon in the summers, that exhibit appears a little darker than what you would think it should be.
What does a baby penguin look like? Like just the day it's hatched within 24 hours.
Right now, to me, it looks like a little pterodactyl. They don't have any down on them whatsoever. They don't move around that much. So they're not the cutest of birds that you see, but it doesn't take long for them to start growing that down. And king penguins have a brown down, and after, you know, a month's period of time, they are the most adorable things that you could ever see. They're these big brown fluff balls.
So a month from now, we should then go back to the zoo.
Correct. Yeah. In a month-ish, you know, 2 months, they'll be almost adult size. But
when you say they, it's because there is this other one on the way.
Yeah, we hope.
So do you already have names picked out for that one?
No, not yet. We didn't last time either. It just so happened that it happened during that storm. And one of our gentlemen that works on our facilities team said, you should name it Blizzard because of the snow. So Wenzel gets credit for that.
So there are other small animals, little fresh babies at the zoo right now. Two giraffes?
We do. You know, if you haven't seen the giraffes, one of them in particular made quite the statement last year on social media. I don't remember how many hits. I'm not a big social media person, but it was a lot. Millions and millions of people looked at her. And she actually had a brother that was born later on in the year to another female. Both were first-time moms, so again, it's that jittery feeling with the keeper staff, wondering how they'll do. They did an amazing job.
What is, in the giraffe world, what is doing an amazing job as a new mom?
Just caring for them, feeding them, making sure that they're healthy, protecting them, and not that they have to protect them from lions at a zoo, but, you know, making sure that none of the other giraffes are being a little too rough on them. So the main thing is really just the nourishment part of things and getting them to the point where they can fend for themselves. And now they're still smaller and they're still younger, but they grow at an amazing rate. Dixie was 5 feet tall when she was born, and now I think she's pushing 7 feet already.
7 feet?
Right.
How tall is a full-grown giraffe, just for comparison?
Well, a male can get, and it depends on genetics, too, because it's just like humans. You have some really tall humans and some really short ones, but a really tall male can get over 18 feet tall.
Holy moly.
That's amazing, yeah.
So I do, like, picture when I think of a young giraffe, I don't know where this comes from, but I picture, like, a super wobbly, like, cuddly, like, knob-kneed creature. Is that what it's like?
Very, yeah. But as is the case with a lot of animals that are plains herd type of animals, they have to get up and going relatively quickly. Otherwise, they're going to be somebody's dinner. And giraffes are no different. So it doesn't take them that long before they're standing. Now, I wouldn't necessarily say running, but it is pretty cute to watch them take their first steps. And it is very, you know, knock-kneed and wobbly. And when you're dealing with an animal that's 5 or 6 feet tall, it's even that much more pronounced because of the fact that they're moving around with these big limbs that they're not used to using.
Just a giant baby.
Right.
Birth in a zoo seems like it's kind of a funny thing because it's happening among scientists. But do you get sentimental about what it is you're witnessing from the birth itself through those, like, you know, those cherished early moments, I guess, throughout that first year or so?
I think that's a lot of why we're all in it. You get those experiences, those special times. But I would say, you know, even if you were to watch something be born or hatched and you're witnessing it, that is a cherished time. But it's even more about growing with that animal, you know, especially those animals that are long-lived and you have relationships, whether it be an elephant or a chimpanzee and an orangutan, who are living decades, not years, but decades. You have these attachments to those animals, and it's almost like they're family. The keeper staff are working with them on a daily basis, and they do grow very close to them.
So we have talked about the just-born baby penguin and his soon-to-be brother or sister arrive, or I guess colony mate is how you'd put that, coming soon. And then we've talked about a couple of young giraffes within their first year. There are some young primates at the zoo, too.
They are pretty adorable as well. We have, across the board, all of our great apes have had babies over the last 3 years. We've got three young chimps, and we have a two-year-old orangutan and a three-year-old gorilla. And just as this is the case with humans, that is a time of play, and they will go out and explore and do things that that you would see a 3 or 4 year old child do out in the yard. Just do somersaults for no reason whatsoever.
Can you give me another example of like a baby primates do the darndest things kind of situation?
Oh, we just I think this is they're going to put this out on social media sometime over the next couple of days. But we gave a giant stuffed orangutan to Dusty, our young orangutan, the other day. And he just tossed it up in the air and flipped it around. And again, it's just something that you would see a young human do at that age, too. But it was adorable.
Have you been open at the zoo since the Chiefs loss? Were you open yesterday?
We were. It was a very down time. We did have quite a few people visit the zoo, even though it was cold yesterday. I think a lot of people were trying to take advantage of some family time with the holiday. I sense even on with staff, there's a lot of staff that are a little depressed after Sunday.
But do baby animals help them?
I would think so. It allows for an outlet to think about something else as opposed to just thinking about the what ifs and Super Bowl.
Well, Sean Putney, Director of Zoological Operations at the Kansas City Zoo, thank you. And send us pictures of all the baby animals.
Thanks
always.
For having us.
A baby penguin was born at the zoo on January 13th. His name is Blizzard. Up next, the experimental Kansas City filmmaker headed to Sundance. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're talking with Chris Good. He's a Kansas City filmmaker whose recent project, a short film called Crude Oil, made it to Sundance, the big time film festival that you have probably heard of, starts in just a couple of days. So we wanted to hear Chris's story heading into it, and we'll find out a little more about his movie, too. Hi, Chris. Congratulations.
Hi, Gina. Thank you.
Are you just so like, what, this is happening?
A little bit. It's very exciting. We're all thrilled, of course.
Well, I want to back up and say this is a movie with humble origins. You funded it with a Kickstarter. Can you tell me that story?
It's true. We've sort of gone back to the Kickstarter well a few times now. I don't know. It's a good way to build an audience, I suppose, a little bit before you even make the movie, because there are people, you know, probably more emotionally invested in it than even, you know, because
like they've been along for the ride.
Yeah, kind of.
Do you, when you say we, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about myself and Andrina Byrne, who's the producer and star of Crude Oil. And, of course, everyone else involved, but Andrina and I kind of were the ones involved with the Kickstarter, mostly.
So she stars in it. Which of the two young women there? We'll get into the plot in a minute, but which is it, Lynn or
Jenny?
Jenny.
Yeah, sort of the yeah. That's Andrina.
Well, I have watched the movie, and I will describe it in a second. But I want to hear how you describe it first. So, just a few sentences. How would you describe Crude Oil?
See, I was excited about you having seen it and hoping that you would do that legwork because I'm terrible at things like this. But to me, it's sort of just about kind of an overbearing friendship and someone breaking away from that. You know, maybe that sounds too simple, but it's only 15 minutes long, so not
it
that
is
much.
Only 15 minutes.
I mean, actually, kind of a lot happens, but but told in a very stylized, dreamlike way, I suppose.
This is not very different from my description. My version is it's an experimental film that's kind of like a psychological thriller that's very stylized, that is almost like a comic book in movie form. You know how in comic books there's like a pow or something and you kind of imagine everything is shaking in that frame or something? Things like there are moments like that in this movie. It's about a particular type of female friendship, I would say. Like, I have witnessed this friendship. There's the charismatic queen bee who runs around with a more insecure-seeming sidekick who kind of lives in the other girl's shadow. But it's told in this very fantasy way where they both have superpowers that they've kept secret from one another.
Exactly. Yeah. That's amazing. That's,
I'm glad that I would see that seems like an accurate description because it is, you know, it's not a straightforward plot.
No. No, it's, yeah, not meandering, but maybe labyrinthine. I don't know. I'm not sure what. Digressive, perhaps, at times.
Now, the plot on the face of it is kind of insane, but what kind of anchors it to me is that the script and the acting totally make it work. Like, the characters are very convincing, and like I said, I know these young women. I get this friendship. I've seen this friendship, and I've seen how it falls apart. Do you think that there is something to that, like, that the characters themselves are so believable and so realistic that you can kind of have fun in these other realms?
That was the goal, pretty much. I mean, to me, the characters, like, I feel like a lot of times if you see a movie that's very heavily stylized, the characters might also be sort of, as they say, quirky. Or, like, to me, the characters are like people that I grew up with in Lenexa. You know, like, they're not,
you they're know. Relatable.
Yeah.
Except for this whole superpower thing, which...
Except for a superpower.
Which seems like a metaphor, but we'll talk about that. I want to play a clip first. In this scene, Lynn is getting ready to move to Bloomington, Indiana. Jenny is wondering who she'll be without this controlling friend in her life. So Jenny tries to bond real quick by revealing some very personal information, like literally Lynn is in the U-Haul ready to pull out of the driveway. And this is what Jenny says.
But she's also my best friend. Like, we're basically sisters. I can talk to Lynn about anything.
Okay. Well, I'll text you later.
There's actually something I haven't told you about me.
Well, I gotta get going.
I can make people smell things. Things that they might not want to smell necessarily.
What are you talking about?
Here. Do you smell cinnamon buns?
No.
Okay. Do you smell fish? But not like 100% fresh fish.
I don't smell anything.
Okay. Do you smell cat shit?
And with that, Lynn drives away.
Chris. Yeah, she's off to Bloomington.
That is this best friends for years goodbye. And it's what people can't see, but I think they can get a sense of, even just with the sound effects, is that, you know, Lynn's face is just like contorting. She clearly smells everything that her friend Jenny is conjuring with her superpower of being able to make people smell whatever she wants to make them smell.
Yes, and yet denies that, you know, Jenny's power is effective.
So. Why do you think she does that?
Well, you know, she's still attempting to, you know, maintain her dominance over... You know, I don't know. Like, you know, if you are engaged in some sort of psychological warfare with someone, you'll deny lots of things, I suppose. And certainly the other person's efficacy. I don't know.
Yeah, like, nope, what you're doing is not impressive.
Exactly.
To me. This isn't real.
Yeah.
So this movie, Crude Oil, is going to be screening at Sundance next weekend. But tell me about yourself. I hear you've always got some kind of movie in the works.
I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, roughly. I mean, we do a lot of music videos, so I'm sort of frequently tied up with those. Although we're kind of wrapping up.
For local bands in Kansas City?
More, not too many Kansas City bands. We did a video or two for Shy Boys. They're from Kansas City, but mostly outside Kansas City. But yeah, we're wrapping up a large music video project right now. And after that, I'll have a blank slate, which will be nice.
And you've mentioned you're from Lenexa?
It's true.
Tell me about growing up and like when movies came into the picture for you.
Originally, I wanted to write and draw comic books. I drew a lot. Received a lot of positive reinforcement for that compulsion. And then eventually kind of drifted into film.
Can you like describe the drifting into film a little bit more? Was there something you saw or an idea you had that kind of set you down that path?
I think it was a natural progression from the comic books because it's similar, you know, here's a picture from this angle of this person doing this thing and then this other angle. So, but, you know, probably drawing comic, that seems like a very lonely fate. Just like sitting in a room, like, or actually
you do it by yourself unless you're like a writer illustrator pair.
Yeah, I suppose if you were in the old days, I don't know how I've sort of lost touch with such things, but I suppose in the old days I can imagine, you know, being in an office in, you know, Marvel in New York City and it's like one big room for everyone, but I doubt it's like that. Or certainly the types of comic books I would have been making would just been a very solitary affair. So, you know, I think that would have been poor for my mental health. And movies are obviously more community based.
Well, so going back to like being this person who's from Lenexa, though, I mean, and you talked about that these characters in what I hope you don't mind my calling a pretty weird movie.
Yeah.
That they are just so, in some ways, like they're characters everyone knows, no matter what social circles they run in or what kind of place they're from. Do you think that that is a kind of character who appeals to you based on like where you're from? Is it important for you that your films speak to like a Midwestern suburban reality?
I'm not sure. I mean, the Lenexa remark is probably just some glib reply, but I think all I meant was that, like you said, it was important because the filmmaking is so stylized that the emotions are rooted in sort of, I mean, like you say, just every, you know, people can, I think we've all seen this dynamic in some form or another or experienced it perhaps.
You know, but the movie also does feel very Midwestern to me in its details, like that when the Queen Bee type character is moving away, she's going to Bloomington, Indiana, and that her friend Jenny, who's left behind, you have like the scene of her wandering through a cornfield.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we shot it around here. So, and of course, yeah, growing up in the Midwest has infiltrated my psyche through numerous, I don't know where I'm going with the sentence, but yeah, it is Midwestern, you know, it's a Midwestern film. I don't know what that means. That can be a new genre, I suppose.
Midwestern.
Yeah. A Midwestern. Exactly. It works.
So the actors, too. I mean, you mentioned that you've got sort of like a partner in crime, a producer who was playing the Jenny character. I also happen to like recognize someone in this movie who has served me coffee and beer around town. And who I don't believe is a professional actor. He does great in his role, but I am guessing that this is a cast of your friends.
It is, yeah. I mean, even the professional actors, of which there are a couple, are more friends certainly than not. I mean, Tipper, who plays Lynn, the Queen Bee, as you say, is one of my best friends. And I mean, most of the people involved with this movie are my best friends. But yeah, definitely. The person you refer to, Alex Moss, I believe, he portrays a possessed pizza preparer.
Yeah, and he's
this movie sounds really bizarre. Huh?
Yeah, he's just like sprinkling this pizza with endless olives. Like yeah. He doesn't even know what he's doing because he's not in control of his own mind.
Yeah,
and he's making pizza. What are you gonna do?
Yeah, it's a crying shame.
But so, okay, making movies with your friends, is that's like I feel like that's like every 14-year-old's dream of like where you end up in life.
Yeah.
And movies, maybe. Making movies with your friends that end up in Sundance.
Yeah. That's ideal for sure. Yeah, it's great. It's very exciting right now. And
can you tell me about finding out that this whole like Sundance part of the journey?
Yeah. I was out of the country, actually, and they call, which is nice. They call everyone, even the shorts, they call. But I didn't get that. My phone wasn't really working at the time. And so I think I kind of woke up and, like, rolled over and saw that I had a missed call, which kind of, I think, shows up, you know, if you have Sprint overseas, it's not very, you know, it shows up, like, way late. And so, but I didn't think anything of it. And then I bought a Wi-Fi pass and looked at my email, and there was just this email that you sort of stare at for a minute because it doesn't seem real. You're am I misreading this?
Like, is there like a subject line that's like film accepted into Sundance?
Yeah, the subject line was just like, I think it was crude oil Sundance invitation. So, you know, that was rather jarring to see. And then I opened the email and it has a big logo. You know, I suppose I'm sure hackers can create a fake email with a big Sundance logo. It's not that sophisticated, I suppose. But to my mind, it was like, oh, this looks legit. And yeah.
So it was that serious that you're like evaluating how professional the logo appears to be like, is this?
Yeah, you know, maybe like I wronged someone in the past who's trying to like play some horrible prank on me or something. Like, it's possible. You know, but it seemed legit, and I Googled the programmer who wrote to me, and she also seemed legit. Like, she's real. Lisa Ogdy.
So you sit there staring at this. You're confirming the details.
I've just woken up, so I'm especially just staring at things.
Are you going to go? Are you going to see your movie in Sundance?
Yeah, I leave, or me and the production designer, Sinjin Strom, are going to drive. Everyone else is flying. I don't like to fly, so I'm driving. Leaving either today or I've pretty much made the decision to leave tomorrow, but after hearing that weather report, I'm kind of regretting it, because 49, that doesn't sound bad to drive in the winter.
No, it doesn't. Well, so how long of a drive, and like, what are your plans? Do you have special plans for this event, this like?
Yeah, well, it's like a 15-hour drive, give or take. Probably slower, maybe, depending on the snow breaks. But yeah, I mean, already, like, for the first time ever, I am using a digital calendar. First, I was using the Apple one, but then I use Google so I can share it with Andrina. That's more convenient. But yeah, I usually just, like, remember things, but now there's too much going on. In the next week and a half, I have to have a calendar, I'm sorry to say, but I'm sure it's nothing to be ashamed of, I guess.
No, that's nothing to be ashamed of.
But yeah, lots of, you know, it's just a bunch of screenings, 4 screenings of the film. The first one is, I should like give info on what's actually happening. The film premieres on Saturday at 6 p.m. In case anyone listening is going to be at Sundance. Yeah.
That's really cool. So, you know, what in your mind is the best case scenario? Like, what is the best thing that can happen to you at Sundance this next week?
Well, gosh, I don't know. I mean, it has to come from you, I suppose. I mean, I generate my own material, so I feel like it. This is just a way of deflecting your question. Like, I don't want, you know.
You can't even.
I mean, I don't know what would happen, really, that would be. This is like already the best case scenario. Like, we made the movie and it got into Sundance. That's wonderful.
Chris Good, thanks so much and good luck. I hope the whole Sundance experience is amazing.
Thanks very much.
Chris Good's movie, Crude Oil, a little indie short film funded by a Kickstarter campaign here in Kansas City, is going to show at Sundance next weekend. And we are rooting for him. Up next, a little known chapter in the Pendergast story here in KC. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're diving back into a new book on Pendergast that does not focus on the man himself or even on his political corruption. It's sort of about the ripple effect of the Pendergast regime and the far-reaching effects it had on the culture of Kansas City. The book is called Wide Open Town, and the last time we discussed it, we heard about a chapter on a black public hospital, in some ways born of Pendergast's need for the black vote. Well, now we're going to talk about something else that does not get discussed much, female impersonation under Pendergast. My guest is Stuart Hines. He's the curator of the Gay and Lesbian Archive of Mid-America. Hi, Stuart.
Good morning.
So what's the relationship, as you see it, between the history of female impersonation in Kansas City and the Pendergast machine?
Well, female impersonation in this city predates Pendergast, but there's a real transformation during the period that he's in power. And what's interesting is...
A transformation of what kind?
A transformation in the way that the performances were presented. Sort of in the early part of Pendergast and prior, it was really part of vaudeville, which happens in theaters. And then as time goes by and prohibition comes and goes, you see vaudeville sort of disappear and... That aspect of that kind of performance starts to take place in cabarets and nightclubs. And then with the repeal of prohibition, you see female impersonation disappear across the country because it was a phenomenon that didn't just occur here. And you see it disappear in cities like New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and smaller cities, but it...
Because the venues themselves are disappearing?
Not necessarily, no. It's because legal authority... gets involved again with the distribution consumption of alcohol and also the places where alcohol is consumed. So they really put the clamp down on some of the wild behavior that was going on during Prohibition. Because Kansas City is still a wide open town after Prohibition is repealed in 1933, you still see evidence, lots more evidence of female impersonation going on here because... that clampdown hasn't happened in the clubs in Kansas City because of Pendergast's influence.
So before we get too far into it, I want to talk about the terminology here. You use the phrase female impersonation. There are a lot of other terms that some folks use kind of interchangeably with that one. Can you explain why this is the phrase that you've chosen?
Because I focus primarily on performative. Not necessarily what was called back in the day cross-dressing, really looking at people who are doing this as a theatrical performance or a nightclub performance, not folks who are just out in public
living their lives.
Living their lives. And in the research that I've done, you start to see female impersonation and drag sort of used interchangeably. Kind of during this period and after, mostly after. But what's also interesting is that in Kansas City, appearing in public in clothing inappropriate for your sex, according to the law, is illegal. And so you see accounts of people who are cross-dressing, in quotation marks, on the street being arrested, yet people on the stage being allowed to perform.
And this is... Again, during the Pendergast years.
This is during Pendergast and before.
So can you explain to me, we'll get more into some of those distinctions, but what got you interested in this topic? Was there something that you saw in the archive that really got you like thinking, huh?
When the archive started, one of our partners was the Kansas City Museum. And at that time, they had a program called Community Curator, where they would invite someone from the community in to look at an object or collection and then do an essay and a presentation on those pieces. And I was asked to look at the collection of Melinda Ryder, longtime female impersonator here in Kansas City. And that's what got me started. It's about 6 years ago, 7 years ago now. And the more I looked at it, the more fascinating it became because it predates the Civil War. And in Kansas City, and it's just this thread of theatrical history that's been there all along, but nobody's really picked it up and looked at it.
So there are specific venues and specific characters who kind of populate this chapter of your book.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can talk about who some of these people are, what some of these places are, and kind of help us get into the larger story with those really, like, tangible kinds of details.
Sure. at the beginning of the Pendergast era in the 20s, you see a lot of vaudeville happening in really nice theaters like the Orpheum, which was at 14th in Baltimore. And the Orpheum really was the Kaufman Center of its day. It was decked out. It was gorgeously built, and it drew the cream of the crop of the city. And typically on a weekly basis, there was a vaudeville performance that usually featured some sort of female impersonator. You had people like Carol Norman, people like Julian L. Tinge, who's talked about in the article, and Bert Savoy. And L. Tinge was an early 20th century female impersonator, and really, I explain it to students that he was the RuPaul of his day. He was known nationally as an impersonator. And it's a different kind of female impersonation than we think of today. It's not an exaggeration of womanhood. It's really more of an attempt to pass as a woman. And he was really good at it. And his clothes, his demeanor, his posture, his walk, his soprano voice. And then you start to see female impersonators come on the vaudeville scene, like Bert Savoy, who's more like the kind of drag queens that we see today. Much more exaggerated, much more humorous.
Is this a chronological progression?
Yeah. And he dies in 1923. And then as vaudeville sort of fades away and you see the rise of these nightclubs, in December of 33, there's a club that opens up at Independence Avenue in Troost called Dante's Inferno. And that location now is where the Admiral Bridge crosses over I-35 and meets with Independence Avenue.
I know exactly where you're talking about.
That's where the club was. And that becomes the center of female impersonation in Kansas City. It becomes a club known for impersonation.
Dante's Inferno.
And as a matter of fact, some of the other clubs that advertise after Prohibition, when they can advertise, some of the clubs over in the 12th and Vine and the 18th and Vine district, they typically had a night during the week that was a female impersonator's night. And some of the ads mentioned that they feature impersonators from Dante's Inferno.
So that was like cred.
Yes, exactly. It was so well known that it did lend them credence to the fact that they had these good performers performing at their nightclub.
So I know that you were not alive at this time and therefore don't have that level of firsthand experience, but through like poring over archival materials, what is your sense of like what the scene was there at Dante's Inferno?
I think it was a lot of fun. There's a really interesting interview, an oral history with a woman who performed at Dante's that was done in the 1980s. And unfortunately, she was suffering from some dementia at that time, so her memory's a little unclear. But it just sounded like it was a really good time. They had a rotating group of performers who would come through. There was a circuit at that time.
Like regulars.
Right. They had regulars who would come from out of town and perform. And there are a number of images of those performers in this woman's collection. And it just really looked like it was a great time because the club itself was designed, because it's Dante's Inferno, so it was designed with this hellish theme. So little demons everywhere. And apparently it was designed such that a staff member would come out from the wall and scare people and all that kind of thing. So it just seemed like it was a kind of a raucous environment.
I mean, in today's context, it's hard not to look at this as that there was some greater acceptance of gender fluidity than there might have been in other places, or just at least playing with gender roles, playing with gender stereotypes. Is that the case, or is this really strictly related to Kansas City's openness when it came to things that were considered taboo, if not outright illegal?
I think it's challenging to sort of pinpoint people's attitudes about gender fluidity because there's not a lot of record around that. But just the fact that you have interviews with musicians from the same period who talked about their own acceptance of these kinds of performers and how they would draw crowds and contribute to the kitty. It would indicate that there was, at least on the part of these heteronormative musicians an acceptance of this kind of performance and this kind of lifestyle, in quotation marks. And so that's not uncommon, like I said, particularly during the prior to the repeal of Prohibition. You see an amazing amount of drag in the United States, particularly in New York.
Throughout the country.
But the center, like so many things, the center was New York. They had drag balls in Harlem in the late 1920s that would draw 6,000 people and be covered by mainstream press. And that leads to what becomes known as the pansy craze, a straight crowd who would want to go and just observe and watch this parade of these non-binary folks, for lack of a better term, strut their stuff as part of these balls.
And this is the 1920s.
This is in the 1920s. Yeah.
And then Prohibition comes, and throughout most of the country, things change and become a lot more restrictive, except you're saying in Kansas City, that's not the case. And I'm curious, you know, Kansas City loves to talk about Pendergast. If I may say, we especially like to rehash the same parts of the Pendergast story. So the fact
over
that,
and over.
Right.
Yes.
The fact that this is a part of the story I've never heard intrigues me. And I'm wondering what you think we miss when we don't look at this part of the story.
Well, I think you miss some really interesting evidence of the perimeters, the sideline of the city and the city's cultural activity, and things get swallowed up by the overarching narrative of Pendergast and the rise of jazz, and so you. It takes a book like this, because all of the essays, the overwhelming majority of essays, look at things like General Hospital Number 2 and these aspects of this period that haven't really been examined very closely. And that was kind of the thrust of the book, was to present some new research into this Pendergast period so that we weren't telling the same story again over and over.
When you think about the narrative that this is all usually part of is the narrative of Pendergast and debauchery and corruption and sort of like the almost like the Hollywood version of Pendergast in some way. If you instead see the narrative as the story of gay and lesbian history in Kansas City, which is what you are sort of charged with keeping alive or bringing to life as the head of this archive, what is that story? Where does this piece of it fit in?
It's very challenging to find documentation of gay and lesbian lives during this period and before. So we have to make presumptions, and we have to take whatever little nibble that we can get and extrapolate from that. And that's what's so wonderful about this particular story, is the fact that this collection from this woman exists. It actually is housed at the University of Kansas, but it's absolutely fascinating in terms of the stuff that she saved and how she saved it and why she saved it. And
can you tell that story?
Sure. Like I said, she was a performer at Dante's Inferno. She was a singer. And again, this is back when female impersonators sang their own songs, and that they were singers. And she performed at Dante's for a few years and then went off and toured. But she saved these scrapbooks of her time there, and she opened up a club actually in Riverside after she came back from touring, and saved a bunch of stuff around that nightclub as well. And it was clearly a very important facet of her life as a mother and a wife and a performer. And it's a really fascinating window that you just don't get to look through very often.
And do you not get to look through it because of how that kind of openness seemed to fade away in most cities? I mean, is the fact that it stayed a, quote, wide open town here, is that part of why we have something like this?
It's very possible. And it's, I think the other reason is that people just didn't feel like it was important enough to save or was worth saving.
Well, Stuart Hines, with us from the Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Stuart is one of the contributing authors of the book Wide Open Town, Kansas City and the Pendergast Era, and we've been enjoying the fresh takes on history that this anthology has presented with us. Stuart wrote about female impersonation here in town and how it relates to Pendergast's impact on culture. That's a wrap. You can enjoy any of the conversations you might have missed on today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's also where you can sign up to have all our shows sent to you like a podcast for your listening convenience. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, two mayors, a Prairie Village mayor and who is on her way out, and a Leavenworth mayor on his way in. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman.